Hello and welcome everybody to a very special edition of Podcasting Them Softly. We're delighted to have Matthew Wilder on our podcast today. Matthew's a filmmaker who wrote and directed Your Name Here, starring Bill Pullman and Tracy Lords. He also spent over 20 years directing in the theater. His upcoming projects are co-writing with Paul Schrader his new film starring Nicolas Cage called Dog Eat World or Dog Eat Dog, based on Edward Bunker's novel. Dog Eat World's a sequel.
Yeah.
Okay.
It's gonna be so much bigger. Yeah. It's gonna be like World War Z. But please carry on.
Okay. Awesome. Matthew's currently casting his next film, Old Money, as well as his involvement in an upcoming miniseries of Norman Mailer's Harlot's Ghost that is being produced by Constantine Films. Both Nick and myself have been friends with Matthew since the birth of Podcasting Them Softly and have thoroughly enjoyed his Facebook monologues on hipsters, Miley Cyrus, and an insider's view to L.A. So thank you very much for coming on the show, man. It's been a long time coming.
My pleasure.
Thanks a lot for coming on the show, man. Nice to meet you over Skype. Like I said before, it's definitely be a cool chat.
Thanks.
So our whole idea with bringing Matthew Wilder on our show today was we were going to do this sort of fall television wrap-up slash upcoming stuff because the three of us thoroughly enjoyed the second season of True Detective. We're also going to discuss The Leftovers, which is coming back to HBO in October, and we are going to talk a little bit about Dahl and M, and The Nick, which is on Cinemax, which I just ordered on Blu-ray, and I know Matthew and Nick are obsessed with it, and apparently it's now streaming on HBO Go, HBO Now, so I kind of missed the boat on that one and just went right for the Blu-ray, so that's kind of our idea for this podcast. So just going to ask real quick, what was your take on the second season of True Detective? Because I know we had some interesting and colorful conversations about the second season throughout its duration.
Well, here's my take on it. I mean, to me, this is a real line in the sand, like where this season of True Detective really went. Like, to me, it really, when you talk to people about it, it speaks to me to something that's bigger than just this one TV show, which is it really tells you a lot about people, about what they think is cool, what they think is embarrassing, what they think is acceptable. And it's a real, to me, it's a real litmus test because this season began, I think, you know, I don't know if you guys would agree with this, but I think most people felt the first couple of episodes, I was not really down with it. I kind of felt like the vision of L.A., as somebody who lives in L.A., I felt like the vision of L.A. was all wrong, which is weird because it's kind of hard to miss. It's not a complicated vibe to kind of capture this city. I feel like they miss that, and there's a lot of the most, you know, Cormac McCarthy kind of ponderous philosophical dialogue and so on, and I thought, oh, man, this is going to a bad place. What I really took away from the end of this series was if you watch this really play itself out, the struggles of these characters, to me, were so moving and so raw and so naked and powerful that all the whatever sort of qualms you might have about the plotting or about certain elements of the show were just blown away by the fact that these characters were so broken, they were so wounded, they're so desperately trying to pull their lives back together, and some of them totally failed in that attempt to do that. And I found that so incredibly powerful and moving. And the thing to me that just kind of pisses me off when people just, you know, throw this show away is, okay, there are all these things that you think are sort of uncool in the show, but there's something deeper to this that I think is really emotionally powerful that I feel like a lot of people just, they decide it was uncool, it was corny, it was too macho or whatever, and they just kissed it off. And I to me, it's just a real litmus test with people. It's a real line in the sand.
I couldn't agree more with you on that, aside from, I mean, I was heavily wrapped into the second season from that, like, that 60-minute teaser that HBO ran. I can't remember when they ran it, because the second season premiered in June, so it must have been, like, when Game of Thrones was wrapping up or something like that, but... I mean, from the first couple episodes, I was completely drawn into it, and I mean, I've never been to LA, so I don't really know the essence of it, and I've never, you know what I mean, I don't have your view of it, but I was just very heavily drawn into it due to the parallels from films like The Long Good Friday,
mm-hmm.
and Chinatown to a certain extent, and, you know, David Lynch, and everything that was just kind of this cinematic culmination of things that I really, really love, all kind of thrown together.
Yeah.
You know, like the pulpy dialogue, the over-the-top dialogue and brooding from the characters I really love, too, because it reminded me a lot of the Parker novels.
Uh-huh.
And stuff. So, yeah, I get that. And I remember having conversations with you early on about it and about Nick Pizzolatto. And then... I remember we did have that fun conversation about Rachel McAdams and the e-cigarettes, and yes. you found that Tumblr and got
posting. Oh my God, fantastic! It's like just gifs of vaping. It's fantastic.
It's awesome. I loved it even more because I was that asshole that tried vaping for a time, and I was just like, "What am I doing? Why even bother?"
Yeah,
I would doing this. I'd have to probably chime in and say that I'm with Matt. Matthew on pretty much everything he said. I thought the first, for me, it was a show that got better as it went along. It was like episode 3 is when I was like, oh wow, okay, I'm really excited now. And then episode 4 with the shootout, I was even more engaged. The first couple episodes left me wanting a little bit, and I don't know if it was just the it was coming down from the high that the first season left on me personally. I really enjoyed, you know, all of the elements from season one, the two performances, and even if you want to call it four performances, because, you know, McConaughey and Harrelson basically gave you two performances each episode, you know, depending on the timeline and the shifting of the narrative. But I loved the ending of how it wrapped up, and I thought it was just fantastic. And I guess it was just one of those things where you had to get used to the new setting, new characters, and throwing a lot of plot at you. I definitely came down on the show in the sense that not in a bad way. When I maybe not came down, but I saw it as like a junior Michael Mann thing, big time. James Ellroy in there as well. Definitely the Chinatown stuff. The Long Good Friday for sure. Numerous you know, genre touchstones, but I couldn't help but feel that there was sort of this like overriding pseudo Michael Mann approach, you know, the notions of existentialism and, you know, macho posturing and, you know, how men interact with each other in the line of duty, and obviously throwing in the Rachel McAdams character there to subvert some of those expectations. Did you guys pick up on the Michael Mann stuff? Because I know when we spoke to, you know, when we had our chance to speak with Nigel Bluck, he said that that was one of his visual inspirations. What did you guys think?
You want to take that?
Yeah. Yes, certainly. I think that the second to last episode with Vince Vaughn's character burning down all of his businesses and the progression of that episode were certainly along the lines of Thief.
Thief, yeah.
That was, I mean, that for sure. And I think that his character was a culmination of Harold Shant from The Long Good Friday, and then as well as Thief. James Caan from Thief. His name was also Frank. I can't remember his last name in the film, but I think that he wasn't as smart as James Caan was in Thief. I guess he kind of was, because I had this impression of Vince Vaughn's character as kind of like this shitty Chicago gangster that was in way over his head, which to a certain degree he was, because he got taken advantage of by all these rich bureaucrats and politicians that just took him for his money. But I mean, the last couple of episodes, I really loved his character, and I think I may have loved his character more than I loved Colin Farrell, and I loved Colin Farrell's character. I mean, his essentially him reverting back to like that gangster psyche of what originally got him there, where he's just, you know, going to fucking burn everything down and shoot everybody that fucked him over. I love that. And I couldn't agree more. And Matthew, you want to chime in?
I will just say, you know, when I was thinking of the show this season, I guess I was not thinking of it directorially as much. I think people have made a lot of noise about the lack of Cary Fukunaga, and I didn't feel the loss really that much. There was one thing that I thought was absolutely dazzling. It was one of those really ballsy moments, like when Quentin uses the music from Cat People in Inglourious Basterds. You just go, okay, this is perfect, but it's so weird, and who would have the balls to take this song everyone knows and just make a whole set piece out of it? There's a scene where Rachel McAdams goes into that sort of Eyes Wide Shut orgy of the rich guys and the rich bureaucrats and so forth, and she goes in as, you know, undercover as a hooker. And when she's sort of loping around and kind of scoping out the place, they use what is my favorite contemporary classical composition, John Adams' Harmony Lyra, which is this huge, moody, strange piece that sounds like an oil tanker, you know, floating by you. And he put that in like 6 or 7 minutes of her kind of roaming around this orgy. And I just thought, what balls! Like, it's just the strangest music cue to pull that one out. That probably nobody watching this, very few people know this piece, but it's so, it's like Bernard Herrmann, you know, it's sort of like moody and dreamlike. And I thought that was just brilliant. And I thought there were a lot of things like that. I thought the constant return to that bar, you know, where the girl is playing the guitar and you're kind of never sure whether it's the afterlife or it's like a dream place that they're going. You know, the exposition comes out there, but it's sort of this place that doesn't seem at all real. I love stuff like that, just for its own sake. I just found it so ballsy, you know? It's just very, very rich.
The choice of music in that scene stuck out to me immediately. And I'm also thinking about how, you know, many people brought up the David Lynch aspects, the dreaminess aspect, and at times I thought I was watching like a Michael Mann crossed with a David Lynch,
yeah,
you know, type thing. One of the things that I found so fascinating, and we'll touch on this, you know, this trend, because it's extended itself to numerous television shows, most of which I found to be extremely good, is the notion of one director presiding over a TV show like Soderbergh on The Nick and Fukunaga on the first season of True Detective. Trying to remember the guy's name, who does Fargo. His name, of course, is escaping me right now. But I believe he directed every episode of Fargo. And Matthew, I don't know if you saw The Missing. I can't recommend that show enough. Like, it's amazing. I've been all over Frank to see it as well. Are you familiar with The Missing?
I've heard of it. I have not seen it.
It's terrific, and it's another show directed by the same guy. I believe his name is Matt. I'm trying to remember his name. Can't remember his name off the top of my head. Every episode directed by the same guy. The episode written by the same two people. This amazing, you know, kidnapping narrative told on three different time tracks. But one of the things I love so much about some of these new shows is how there seems to be a unifying thing that's pulling everything together. And here in True Detective season two, it was sort of felt less about a director's vision and more about Pizzolatto's vision, which is a very unique thing in the sense that his name isn't showing up as a director per se. But if you know enough about him and his work and his tendencies, and I just can't help but feel that he was really the one, and maybe I'm wrong, but he was really the one calling all of the shots, whereas maybe the first season was a, you know, a mix of, you know, him and other people.
Right. Yeah, I get that. I mean, for me, you know, the stuff, you know, about both of these seasons, and I obviously I like season one, two, but like the thing for me is I find in Pizzolatto's stuff the genre stuff and the sort of the detecting and how the stories on how the sort of the whodunit of it all unfolds. It's I mean, it works to me. It's not as interesting as the character aspect of it. Like that's the thing to me that really is what's unique about that show. The Colin Farrell thing. I mean, it was like I was watching that and I thought, I don't think I've ever really seen a character who is so much about the sort of the failure of his relationship to his kid, his inability to have custody of the kid, his inability to deal with the kid, how he screws it up when he does get to hang out with the kid, the ways in which he's trying to make that work and not quite getting it, but wanting that other chance. I just saw that and I was like, I don't think I've ever seen anything that kind of captured that, in that way, you know, the Vince Vaughn thing, you know, it's one thing that I think is very sort of LA is, you know, our city is full of a lot of people who are fronting of having a certain amount of money or certain kind of success or whatever, but you know that, you know, 12 hours a day they're running around the way Vince Vaughn is, trying to glue things together and trying to keep it all going, not get their house repossessed or their car or whatever it is. And the dignity with which that guy did it and the risks that he took and the way that he, you know, that he really wanted to go down with his boots on, was very moving to me. I don't know. It's very rare that somebody can draw, characters that vividly and truthfully, you know, and that's to me what made it really work.
Yeah, I just I want to touch upon a couple of points you guys just brought up. I know that the one director not doing the entire second season was a big thing, and when we had the DP Nigel Block from season two on, who worked on the entire season, he talked about how he wouldn't want to work on a show again that just had multiple directors. He'd prefer to work with one director on a show. And I think the interesting thing about the second season is they had the same staff or crew for the entire season. And then they would have, I know Justin Lin did two episodes, and then the guy that did, what the hell's his name? The movie with Hugh Grant about the kid. He did a couple episodes. Okay. He did like the sixth episode, and then he did the finale. I'm with Matthew though. I don't think that the second season was anything but seamless. I didn't miss anything with there not being a known name,
right,
directing each episode. I think that along the lines of what Nick said, I think that there was, I think, you know, it was Pizzolatto's vision, and each director they kind of brought in was just a placeholder,
yeah,
essentially, to maybe make everything move.
It was kind
through
of
sorry to the next episode.
Frank, it's kind of like luck. You know,
yeah, with Michael Mann, right?
Like they presented, from what I, and you know, could be wrong. You never know what you read is true. You know, and I gather that there was a lot of issues between Michael Mann and David Milch. It's like, I can't even believe that they would have put those two guys together, like, on the same show, but whatever. And Matthew, I don't know what you thought of Luck. It seems like something that you would have liked.
Yeah, I did. I very much liked that show, yeah.
Awesome, yeah. I was a huge, huge fan. But from what I gather, didn't they just basically have everything mapped out and they literally handed over a production binder to each director that was like assigned to that show, and they just had to carry out Mann and Milch's, you know, orders?
I don't know if that's true. I mean, it certainly does have a very unified feel. The thing I was just thinking of when you guys mentioned this was one show that I felt like there was a very clear falling for me. There was a very clear falling off directorially was House of Cards, where I felt like the first season was this really dazzling thing where you felt like, wow, this is like a long David Fincher movie. And even when it was like James Foley did a really good job with it, Carl Franklin did some good things with it, but there was a very unified feeling to it, and it really did feel like a Fincher film. And I feel like when you got into season 2 and 3, it was directorially, I think, much more pedestrian. And also, I felt like it just kind of, it just felt like a TV show instead of like, oh my God, this is like a 10-hour movie that we're watching, you know, on Netflix. It became much more TV. It just felt like a smarter version of The Good Wife or something like that. And I think that show is still strong. I think like the stuff with Robin Wright is really good. But that was, I don't know how you guys felt about it. To me, the directorially, you felt like a real falling off.
I loved the first season. I thoroughly enjoyed the second season, and I liked the third season. I can see what you're saying there with the shift, certainly. I think some of, I almost feel like the writing kind of, they had it mapped out, but there was kind of filler in a lot of the episodes, and I think the progression of the first season and the second season were fast and swift and executed very well, and then the third season, where it ends, the ending point of the third season I thought was rather soft, comparatively speaking, to how far the characters had gone in the first two seasons. I mean, I'm looking forward to the fourth season. I still really enjoyed it. I mean, I think it's still better than probably 90% of TV shows or, you know, Netflix shows or whatever I've seen. But yeah, certainly. I mean, I can definitely see where you're coming from. One thing I wanted to circle back to True Detective was about was, I think Matthew brought up an excellent point about Vince Vaughn's character and the dignity and pride he had and the way he goes out in the show. And I remember I would get, unfortunately, I would get into a lot of squabbles on Facebook with people about True Detective, and it was almost getting to the point where, you know, it was just asinine, people's complaints about the show, and you know, and it got into that whole, like, rage-watching or hate-watching, which, I mean, we can get into a little bit, but it was just ridiculous and nonsensical, a lot of things people had to say about it. But, you know, in particular, Vince Vaughn's end on the show with the whole thing with, like, why didn't Vince Vaughn just give the guy his jacket? It's like, dude, you're, like, missing the whole point. Mm-hmm. Of everything about that scene. It's like, first off, Vince Vaughn's been on the other side of that conversation enough times to know that he's going to be left there and he's fucked.
Right.
I mean, you know, and secondly, the guy didn't live his life that long and do everything he did to hand over his jacket just before he gets left in the desert to die.
Right.
You know what I mean? It's like,
right.
What the fuck?
Yeah,
you know, everybody's hang up, and you know, people bitching about the bar scene and how they can't stop laughing at it. I mean, I thought the bar scene was truly remarkable, and I mean, I loved the breaking of the fourth wall with the characters briefly looking into the camera, and you're not sure if they're looking at you or they're looking at the other character or exactly what the focal point is. I thought that was all truly truly remarkable. Especially for a TV show.
I can just say, you know, my experience of this, of season 2 of True Detective, I have one thing that I can make an analogy to, which is I went to the opening night, not the premiere, but just the Friday night opening of AI at the Chinese Theater here in L.A. And somehow, for whatever reason, you know, 2,000 people packed this theater who were all members of the I'm Bitter and I Hate Steven Spielberg Club. Like, every single person in the room was wearing, like, a Spielberg with a cross line through it, you know, T-shirt. And this movie, which I think is one of his best, you know, one of the things that's so cool about that movie is that it's, I think, of all of Spielberg's things, it's like his version of, like, a Cassavetes movie. It's so naked. The emotions in it are so raw. You know, the kid pleading for his mother. The crazy epilogue that takes place 10 billion years into the future. It's so ballsy and it's so emotionally naked and it's so, you know, Spielberg just going for it. And the audience was laughing and mocking and mystery science theater narrating shit back to the screen and yelling things at the screen and stuff. And I by the end, I had tears in my eyes. I was like, I don't know whether I'm more torn apart by the movie or by the assholes in the theater, like, tearing it apart because they don't get it. And it was just to me, it was just a very similar thing in that it's like, yeah, there are things when you are expressing emotion, I think, in a certain really naked way that can be like tee-hee, giggly, silly, that looks stupid. But it's like, if you're going to get hung up by that and you're not going to go to the deeper place of the emotion that that artist is really drawing upon, I pity you. You know, I just feel like, you know, then you deserve really shallow art. Because if you're not going to take that risk along with the artist and go to that embarrassing place, you deserve, you know, vanilla art for the rest of your life, you know? I have no interest in that.
Yeah, I can't agree more. I mean, I hate to sound demeaning, but I've said this a couple times. I know The Walking Dead's a really popular show, and the masses love that show, but... Mm-hmm. I mean, whatever. It's like I love the pilot. I like the first season. I just don't particularly care for it anymore. I tried to watch the spinoff and just couldn't do it. And whatever. I mean, it's just not my thing. But you know, if there's one thing that this whole like train wreck of the fallout from True Detective season two, with all the people rage hating it and just going to social media to get likes and retweets of all their shitty quippy one-liners about the show. It's like there's two types of people in this world. There's True Detective people and there's Walking Dead people.
I've never seen that show, so I can't. Now you got me. I want to go watch it because I've never. Everyone that I know says, they're like, you're not going to like this. You're not going to like this. I was like,
I mean, I'll tell.
They're like, no, you're not going
to. No, you're not going to like it, man.
I gave up on The Walking Dead as well. For me, the pilot was terrific. I'm not a horror zombie, like vampire, like that kind of genre stuff. Like, that's not my thing. It's got to be, you know, like let the right one in or let me in or something along those lines, typically, where I'm excited about that kind of stuff. You know, I enjoyed the slick and fun aspects of like Zack Snyder's updating of Dawn of the Dead. But for me, The Walking Dead was just rinse, wash, repeat every single episode. It was the same thing over and over again. And I just got like tired of like seeing the heads exploding. I was like, wow, like there's nothing novel about this anymore. It was fun the first 500 times you saw a head blow up. And, you know, I think that Frank, your, you know, analogy is right. The, you know, your comparison is right. There's, you know, there's 31 flavors out there for everybody, as we always like to say. But yes, there's people that just want to sit back, watch heads explode. There's other people that want to have to sift through a dense narrative that has a lot of subtlety and a lot of stuff. And, you know, what Matthew was saying about AI and about when people are presented with stuff that's very emotional and upfront and direct and honest and speaks to something that gets under your skin and makes you feel something. There's a lot of people that are going to be cynical about it. And, you know, I lived in LA from, you know, roughly 2000 to 2007. And I remember seeing AI in the theater there and being pretty much blown away by it the first time I saw it. And having maybe not having as of an aggressive cinematic experience as you did, Matthew, there were definitely some people in my theater who were acting, you know, a fool and, you know, not, you know, willing to go there with Spielberg and, you know, with the ideas that were being presented. And, you know, there's a huge section of people, regardless of where they live, whatever, if they live in the coast or in the, you know, the middle of the country or wherever, there's a huge section of people who really don't want to engage with their art. They want to just sit there and let shit wash over them. And I'm all for entertainment once in a while. I'm a big fan of action films. I'm a big fan of, you know, when it's done right. You know, huge fan of that stuff. Every now and then, but you know, your cinematic experiences should be, you know, they should be somewhat nutritious. There should be something there for you to look at and to, you know, examine. And I think that's, you know, to circle back to True Detective, I think that that's one of the things that makes both seasons of True Detective so interesting and unique. And to further agree with Matthew's point from earlier, I sort of became less involved, to be honest, in who killed what was the guy's name they kept saying over and over again? Of course, his name's escaping me. Casper.
Casper, yeah.
I sort of lost track of, like, you know, do I care about who killed Casper? Yeah, enough to keep, you know, enough to have myself involved in that aspect of the story. But I was way more interested in the peripheral elements and the small pieces of detail and, you know, the ballsy nature of breaking the fourth wall and having the guts to write the way that Pizzolatto, you know, clearly enjoys writing. You know, so I guess that's a long way of me saying that I agree. Like, I'm always looking for something that's going to sort of feed the brain and the eyes at the same time, but also being able to make some concessions here and there.
All right, can I ask you guys a question? There's one thing that bugged me, really, in season two of True Detective, and it's just went over my head. Was this intentionally kind of surreal, like a David Lynch thing, that the mayor is, like, slobbering drunk in literally every single moment he's on screen? Like, every single – like, you could see him at breakfast with scrambled eggs and having a scotch in his hand. He's, like, talking like this.
I know.
What was that about? I missed that.
I mean, for me, what I took from it is, I mean, I love Richie Kosser. I think that guy's an amazing character actor, and I love that he was in this. But you're so right, man. He's over the top with just, like, the way he's, like, screaming about Rachel McAdams and, like, calling her a cunt. And he's got that, like, stainless steel,
he's always got,
like,
the
coffee
thermos.
Right. Yes. With, like, the condensation beads on the outside of it. I mean... I thought that character was awesome, and it was a colorful – what I took from it was whenever they showed him in his office, there was always a picture of him and George Bush with their arms around each other.
Yeah.
And, you know, he calls – like later in the second-to-last episode or whatever, he's like hitting on that hooker at the airport or no, that casino or bar that Vince Vaughn owns, yeah. And he's saying how he's like his family's a political dynasty. I just took him as like the visual manifestation of – you know, political corruption and, you know, like a political buffoon that just, you know, was in a dynasty and it was his turn to become mayor of that shitty little city that, you know what I mean? That's what I took from it.
Yeah.
And I thought that there was a lot of parallels between Bush and Chisani or whatever his name was. I mean, not that Bush was drunk all the time, but, you know, that there were two guys that just kind of weren't smart enough or capable of getting their job, but they got their job because of who they are.
Right.
That's my take on it.
Okay. Well, that makes sense.
And not to rehash the Walking Dead thing, I think you should watch the pilot. I think the pilot's very good. The first season's pretty good, but the writing just totally the writing and the acting just gets absurd at times. The guy that plays the lead, Andrew Lincoln's really good. Michael Rooker has a great arc.
He's great
throughout the series, and he's always good in everything. He's probably the best part of the show. But I think that, and this is a good segue to The Leftovers as well, I think this is what you guys brought up, you know. The second season is less about who killed Casper, less about the murder mystery, and people were upset about that. And, you know, with the first season, it was... they were all pissed off about the Yellow King and how, like, the murderer really never got caught, but they caught the one guy. It's like what Matthew said earlier. It's the True Detective is about the characters. It doesn't give a fuck about the murder mystery. That's just, you know, that's part of the show, and that's what's intriguing about the show. But at the bottom line, I mean, the first season's about Matthew McConaughey's character inadvertently finding light in the darkness that he's been living in the past, you know, 20 years or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And then the second season certainly takes a darker turn, and I almost feel like Pizzolatto makes up for the ending of the first season, where you get three out of the, you know, four main characters get killed. Mm-hmm. And it's not a nice death, and, you know, I think the tagline or subtitle of the series certainly is true. We get the world we deserve. I mean, as likable and as much as I loved Vince Vaughn's character and Colin Farrell's character, I mean, they led really shitty lives and did a lot of fucking terrible things that we didn't see because we only saw, I don't know how long the time frame of the show is, probably 6 months to a year of their life. But, I mean... they're so broken by their backstories that you certainly know what they've done in the past, and it sure. wasn't very good.
Yeah.
And, you know, I certainly think that was a thing with The Leftovers, too, because I personally love The Leftovers. I think that's a genius show.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, everybody was so hung up over the finale of season one where it's like, they didn't explain what happened.
You can't.
God, if you didn't just ever expecting an explanation, then the joke was going to be on you. I mean, you can't explain that show. I don't want that show to try to explain to me where those people went. You know, I love The Leftovers. I was very curious about The Leftovers because of how my I don't know where you got. I know, Frank, we've discussed Lost. Matthew, were you a Lost fan?
I've never seen it.
Neither have I.
I like Damon Lindelof. I really love The Leftovers, and I also really like, this is something that's not very popular, I guess, I really like Ridley Scott's Prometheus.
Yes. Prometheus is awesome.
Prometheus is awesome.
Yeah, I love it. I'm glad there's a sequel coming to it. I think it's great.
I was a massive, massive, massive fan of Lost. Lost was something that, like, I used to work like 12 hours a day as an assistant, and I would drive home, you know, over Laurel Canyon, rushing through traffic to get home before, like, I had a TiVo, and, you know, I needed to see Lost at 8 o'clock on ABC. Like, I'm in my apartment. I remember it was like a thing. Like, it was like a fucking thing. And I did not like the ending of Lost. I felt cheated. I was just so disappointed that it got rationalized in the way that it did, and I felt like it was clear that there was no sense of a clear understanding of where this was going to end or how it was going to end, and they can say all they want, but I'll never believe it. So I was kind of mildly, you know, worried that The Leftovers was going to annoy me in some way. And then I realized, wow, they're doing exactly what they need to do with a far-fetched idea. And it's clear they're not going to talk about where these people went or try to present some sort of rationalized reason for something that's totally irrational. You know, and that's what I loved so much about it, is that it's less about the big reason about where those people went and more about the small things and the people and the relationships and the repercussions of what would occur.
I just, you know, I watched it. I think I watched it around the same time that True Detective season two was on. I had a friend who said, you know, nobody was into this, but you got to watch this show. It's really brilliant. And I just devoured it in probably, you know, maybe like 3 nights. And for people who haven't seen it, it's, you know, people probably know what the premise is, which is, you know, 2% of the population of the world disappears in kind of a rapture-like sudden disappearance. We don't know why. They're not particularly good people. They don't seem to be particularly bad people. It's just kind of inexplicable. But the thing that one of the things that's so amazing about this show is, it's about how something like that, it affects a small part of the population, but the fact of that happening completely shatters the psyche of the whole world. And, you know, and we see it in this one community in a town, and you see the ways in which that kind of feeling of something terrible happening that could just happen in a blink of an eye, When you become aware of that or you're impacted by that, it brings on these weird, inexplicable, and terrible kind of side effects. There's a group in the show called the Guilty Remnant who are they dress in white. They smoke cigarettes to show that life doesn't matter. You know, they could drop dead at any time. And their goal, and this to me is so perfect and so true, is – They feel shitty about what happened, and they just want to make everyone else feel terrible too. you know, they're constantly telling people, you got to remember, don't forget. And you go, well, no one's forgetting anything. Like, these people are haunted all their lives by this stuff. You know, because they don't go to a religious sect and wear white clothes doesn't mean that they're not remembering it. But you view these people, you know, they start out as kind of like a religious cult or a very austere religious cult. And by the end, you feel like they're kind of like terrorists. You know, they just want to fuck with people's heads. And there's a great, I guess we probably shouldn't give it away, but the conclusion of the first season, they kind of perform an act on the town to make sure everyone's going to remember the day of the disappearance.
And how fucking epic is that, though? I don't want to spoil it, but I mean, it's like, holy fuck.
It's shattering. I mean, it's one of the most brilliant things ever. I mean, it's just stunning. And I'll just say about The Leftovers, I hope people, if you hear this, go to HBO Go or whatever and watch it, the first season. It's awesome. What I'm concerned about is seeing the trailer for season two. I just have a feeling that someone said, oh my God, this show's so depressing. We got to get them out of there and go somewhere, you know, where they didn't have disappearances, so it can at least start in a happy place. And I just look at that and I go, oh man, that just seems like a drag. I don't want that show to be lightened up, you know.
You got a light vibe from the trailer. I thought it looked.
Yeah, man. It does. It does look ominous with like some shady dealings with like their new neighbors or whatever. But it essentially looked like a reboot in a way.
I agree.
It's like, okay, let's take my new girlfriend, my daughter, and let's drive halfway across the country for a fresh start. I like that idea in a way, and I certainly hope that this is part of one bigger plan, because, you know, that town was so interesting and that town was filled with so many great characters. I mean, Justin Theroux was great. It's one of the best things I think he's done. And I love Scott Glenn in the show.
Awesome as the dad who hears.
Yeah. Who has like this weird premonition or like has an understanding of what happened. And like half the time you think he knows what the fuck's going on. And then the other half, you just think he's senile.
Yeah.
I
agree with the thing though about not ever wanting to know what happened. It's like, to me, it's like, you know, there, I guess people always get upset when there's about to be a remake of The Birds, you know, appropriately so. And it's like, I don't want to know why The Birds are coming, you know, like, scary if, like, oh, there's toxic waste that made them attack people. You know, it's like, that's not scary. What's scary is that they just do it for no reason, and you never know why. You just have to keep running. You know, that's frightening. I don't think there's any explanation that could ever be as good as that idea of disappearance.
Yeah, I totally.
Oh, for sure.
I agree. I don't want them to try and rationalize this at all. It needs to be. Essentially, it needs to be a social experiment of a television show where you would be seeing what would happen to various people at various points in their lives if they were met with something so traumatic. I'd have to watch the trailer again for the second season because I certainly saw a fair amount with the returning cast, but then I also did notice that there was a good chunk that looked like there would be some new characters, and obviously it looked like some of the action was set outside of that town. But it's interesting. I didn't necessarily pick up on the vibes that you guys got, so I'd have to go back and check the trailer out on that again.
Yeah, what keeps me okay with it is I think that if I remember from remembering correctly, the trailer opens with Scott Glenn, like a narration from Scott Glenn, and then you see a good part of Christopher Eccleston and his comatose wife that, like, appears to now not be as comatose or something. I mean, I just don't want them to abandon that stuff because I can't remember which episode it was, but there's an episode with Christopher Eccleston where he's about to lose the church and he goes to the casino.
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, my God. And then he gets robbed and then he smashes the guy's head in and just
so
like,
good.
Oh, and then he just ends up getting fucked. But, yeah, man, there's so much color. There's so much color to those characters, and I think the faux outrage from people over the conclusion of the first season, it's just completely over their head with the show's not about what happened. What happened doesn't matter. What needs to be what you're focusing on is the just aftermath of what happened and you know the chaos. of what happened. I mean, you know, it was so cool that season. They bring in Tom Noonan, which I was all excited about because Tom Noonan's great in everything.
Yeah.
And, you know, there's the creepy black guy that could, like, heal people.
He's fantastic.
Yeah.
If they just look at this thing, oh, it's depressing or something, there's one episode that I feel like everybody should watch. It's a good entree into this show. I can't remember the name. What's the name of the woman who becomes Justin Theroux's girlfriend on the show? She lost people. Whatever.
Something Coon in real life, right?
Yeah, Coons. Whatever her name is.
Oh, seriously. Yeah, Carrie Coon. She was in Gone Girl.
Carrie Coon, right. There's a little bottle episode in it it reminded me of very much. I think they must have been thinking of this. Do you guys know the suitcase episode of Mad Men? It's like the classic episode of Mad Men where it's a night of the awards where Don is taking Peggy around to the different award shows and getting drunker and drunker and drunker and like vomiting into garbage cans.
Yes.
And it's when he opens the elevator door and sees the void, you know, like that whole thing. There's one episode where this character who is, she's lost three people in her family to the departing, and she's become one of the questioners who goes around people who get money from the government. She goes and asks them questions about what happened, and she goes to a convention of people who have jobs connected to the disappearance. And it's very similar to that night of Draper running around with the booze and everything. She has this long night that of meltdown that is just one of the best hours of TV I can recall ever. It's just brilliant. And that actress, Coons, brilliant in it. Just fucking stunning. So I would just say to people who hear this, if you've never seen that show, try that one episode. It is the best, I think.
And a show that, for me, extremely well directed, but using a variety of very talented filmmakers to tell the first season. But a show that felt very unified, despite the fact that there were multiple people, working on it.
Oh, fuck yeah!
I'm trying to think about the people that I know. Obviously, I know Peter Berg did the pilot and the second episode, and I know Carl Franklin did some, and I think Mimi Leader did a few.
Yeah, Linka Glatter did.
Yep, and I think that lady, the Game of Thrones lady, Michelle McLaren, she did one or two or something. So that's a show that had so many pieces to the puzzle, so many ongoing pieces to the puzzle, so many ways that it could go off the rails, so many ways that it could lose track of its focus. And for me, the fact that it didn't do that speaks to the direction and obviously to the way that it's written, being so carefully, measured out. But yeah, I really look forward to seeing the second season. I mean, I know, Frank, you haven't seen it. We've talked about it before. I was a huge fan of Friday Night Lights, which Peter Berg, did for NBC. One of my favorite, network shows. It's funny, all the television that we've been talking about and that we've, people seem to be flipping out for it. It's on FX and AMC and Showtime and, HBO and Cinemax and, now Amazon and everybody else. Stars has their own programming now, which is good stuff as well. But I thought Peter Berg, just the Friday Night Lights TV show on NBC was just amazing. And it just felt so honest. It's in so many moments. And that was one of the things I was really excited about for the Leftovers was seeing him, work on that, at the HBO level on such a tantalizing idea. Did you guys ever see, I'm trying to remember the name of that one that he worked on that he didn't create it, but I believe that he worked on it as a director. It was it Wonder Falls, I think?
Mm-mm. Don't know.
I haven't.
That really short-lived show on Fox?
No.
No.
I'm trying to remember what it was called. He had this really quirky show that he had worked on at one point. It never became a big series, but I know we wanted to talk also as well about a show. I know, Frank, you haven't had a chance to see yet, but Dahl and M, which is going to have its second season on HBO. Matthew, you're a big fan?
Oh, I'm a huge fan of the show. And, you know, the thing that I love about the show is here in our city of Los Angeles, you know, a lot of times you talk to someone, talk to a producer or something, if you have an idea that's sort of, personal or human or something like that, people will say, it's not a big enough idea. It's not a big enough idea. Like, I hear people say that a lot. And the thing that's cool about Dahl and M is it's the ultimate thing that somebody would say it's not a big enough idea about. Because it's a really small idea. It comes from real life. Emily Mortimer, who people probably know from the newsroom, and she's in a lot of movies, she was acting in L.A., in New York, and she had her best friend, who is a sort of less big actress, I mean, a working actress, but not as famous as Emily was in London and had a terrible breakup and was really depressed, and her boyfriend left her and she's in tears. So Emily said, why don't you come over to the U.S. and you could be my assistant. I'll put you on the payroll. You can have a job, you know, you just hang out with me and we'll hang out and pull it together. So the friend, and this is all was true, the friend came over so that Emily would kind of, you know, wipe away her tears and they could hang out and be friends together. But she really did take the job of being her assistant. And once she did, that power dynamic instantly went into effect of I'm the star, you're the flunky, I have the money, you get paid the money, and so on. So the comedy of the show is about the push and pull between their very real friendship and the power dynamic of their lives. And it's a simple, small idea, but it's so well observed, and the actors are just so lovely in it, and it's so funny. It feels almost like it could be like a web series or something. And I think like the way HBO promoted it, it felt a bit like that, but I'm glad to see that they gave it another season. People should really see this. Like, you can watch all six. It's so short, and there's only six episodes in a season. You could watch the whole thing in like 2 hours. It's exquisite.
Yeah,
I'm certainly going to pound that out this weekend.
Yeah, yeah, it's really, really fun. I think, Frank, you'll enjoy it a lot. It's witty, it's funny, it's sharp, it's honest. It's got all those ingredients that you want, in character-based stuff. And it doesn't go over the top in a way that some sort of Hollywood, you know, satires can get at times. But, I couldn't agree more with you. I think it's really really fun show.
It has a really light touch. It's like if Mike Lee did Curb Your Enthusiasm. It's like that.
That's pretty much spot on.
It's not you know, beating the shit out of you. It's just got that light, observant touch. It's witty. I think it's great. I hope people check that out.
And I want to just make a correction because I looked it up. It was not Wonder Falls. That was a different TV show. Peter Berg created a really cool show called Wonderland.
Okay.
And it was all about mental illness, and it was with Ted Levine, Patricia Clarkson, Martin Donovan, Michelle Forbes was in it.
And Jesus, that's a nice
good cast. Yeah,
yeah, and it didn't. It only lasted two episodes on ABC, and wow. I remember when I was working in LA, at the time I was working at Jerry Bruckheimer's place, and it was when Jerry Bruckheimer television was really taking off with CSI and Without a Trace. And he was like really ramping up and realizing, wow, I'm going to, you know, The Amazing Race was a hit, huge hit. And I remember I had a chance to see pretty much, as I recall, all of the episodes of Wonderland because they had gotten it as a screener. It was pulled from ABC and it was sent to DirecTV or something like that. And it was a really good show. And it was one of those shows where it needed to be on an HBO. It was like sort of, it was too good for the networks. But if you guys ever get a chance to see it or track it down, look it up. It's called Wonderland. So,
is it on DVD?
That's a great question. I highly doubt it, but maybe in this day and age, they throw out almost everything now. I mean, you know, it's seemingly, I don't know if it's out on DVD. If it's out on DVD and I've missed it, then I'm remiss in owning it, because it was quite cool. But it only lasted one season, so it was one of those shows that needed more time to get fully fleshed out.
It doesn't appear to be. I just looked it up on IMDb, and I don't see any links to buy physical media. Could be on.
I mean, it was an ABC show,
Amazon or something.
I want to say too that what's this? Brian Grazer and Ron Howard produced it, because then they would go on to produce Friday Night Lights, the movie, like a year later or whatever, that same year for Berg. But and another thing that we know Frank's going to get into soon is the Nick. And Matthew, you're a big Steven Soderbergh fan, from what we can see, right?
I throw something out there, thinking of this, we were talking about this being on DVD. There are two shows that Soderbergh produced. One of them he directed, that only got one season on HBO and are both fucking brilliant.
Yeah.
With John Slattery and James Carville and Mary Matlin and so on. And there's a show that I think was a little bit more Clooney than Soderbergh, Unscripted, about actors in L.A., the actor's life in L.A. Both
of these shows.
What?
Yeah, both of those shows were 11 out of 10 stars for me. I loved both of those shows. Unscripted was genius, and K Street was like so ahead of its time and so awesome, and like a precursor for something. Obviously, it wasn't comedic, but like I feel like the people, I love Veep, and I feel like the people who made Veep, Iannucci, the guy who did In the Loop. I feel like K Street, is like some sort of spiritual cousin, the serious version. But in any event, K Street, Unscripted, love them both. I have both of the seasons on DVD.
I just urge people to go, like, get on Amazon and go. You can get it for like $6 or something. Both of those are awesome. And the concept in K Street was there's a story set in Washington, D.C., and they would do this thing where they would find events, they knew kind of what the episode was going to be, but they would find events that were going on Monday and Tuesday, shoot it like Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, and then cut it so that it went on Sunday night. So you would have things on Sunday night in a fiction show that were news events that happened like 5 days ago.
It's amazing. Like, it's like the South Park of live action satire.
Exactly. Yeah, it's just it's mind blowing. People should definitely check that one out.
Yeah,
I've seen K Street. I haven't seen Unscripted.
It's great.
And I'm trying to remember who's the I remember the guys. There's two leads in that show.
Dude, and Frank Langella is the acting teacher. He's great.
God. And there's that very attractive girl who's in it. That was like Clooney's girlfriend or something at the time, right?
Chris, what's her name? Kristen. Oh fuck, she was in. She's the chick who tells off Chuck Barris in Confessions of a Dangerous Mind. I can't remember her name.
I can't remember her name either, but she's quite good in it. And it's a real good show that deserved longer. It's kind of show where it was ahead of its time, and I feel like now with the success of stuff like. The major success of stuff like Entourage and now to, Episodes, which is on Showtime. I feel like now with the more popularity of like skewering Hollywood, I feel like, Unscripted could have been a bigger hit if it came out now, maybe.
Totally.
It's $5 on DVD. If it's not on HBO Go, I'm totally going to buy it. I might as well just buy it even though I have HBO Go, whatever.
So worth $5.
I don't think it's on HBO Go.
Oh, that's shitty.
It's one of the, it's one of their "we're not so proud of this one"
right.
shows.
But they have all the real sex stuff on there.
Oh, awesome. Do they?
Oh, do they? I think they have both.
Yes.
And I think they have the Cat House stuff, too. So your night is set.
Those are depressing. Those are really fucking depressing. Taxi Cab is entertaining, but the Cat House ones are like, ooh, rough. Rough.
Oh, and you're a fan of the Nick?
huge fan of the Nick Man. If people, I mean, you know, I think people probably know what that is. Such a brilliant show, will make you so glad to, it's one of the few things where you're going to be really glad to be alive in 2015 and not in 1900
when you watch that show.
Oh my God. You realize, like, you know, you could stub your toe and be dead in like an hour. You know?
It's a tough, yeah, it's tough. It's a tough show for it's a tough show for anybody to watch. Pregnant women might want to stay clear, might want to stay clear of it. It is a show that they've taken an almost a gleeful approach to showing how fucked up it would have been to not have anesthesia and not have the appropriate medical instruments and to essentially be writing textbooks as they're going on live subjects. I mean, that's one of the things, and I don't want to spoil this for Frank, but that's just one of the things about the show that has got, aside from Soderbergh's usual aesthetic brilliance with the music and the handheld cinematography, and I could go on and on about his form and technique. I love it. I'm like totally obsessed with it. It is a show, as you said, that will make you appreciate that you are living now, and it is a show that it seems so interested in showing you the birth of doctoring in a way, like, you know, big exam room style doctoring. They're like on a stage and it's like they're performing for like an audience, and it's like sadistic in a way, and I think it's fucking brilliant. And I love how the first season ended with essentially, like, don't the events of the end of the first season of The Nick, aren't those like essentially happening at the same time that Gangs of New York is occurring, like down the street?
Yeah. Absolutely.
Yeah,
the street.
It's like,
that's awesome.
It's like totally amazing the way that the first season ends. Like, doesn't the first season end with the draft riots? Isn't that where it ended?
Yeah, that's what I was just gonna mention. I was gonna say, you know, we were talking at the beginning about, you know, virtuoso directing, and I have to say, you know, people thought like Cary Fukunaga in True Detective was like virtuoso directing. There is a virtuoso thing in The Nick. A lot of The Nick is very intimate. It's set in hospital rooms. It's two people talking to each other, whatever. In episode 7 of The Nick, in the first season, there is a race riot that takes place outside the hospital, and they start breaking into the hospital. And I know, I will bet my rent that Steven Soderbergh had the same number of days, he had the same number of dollars, he had the same everything that he had for everything else on that show. And you see the genius of Soderbergh is, with these huge, long, sweeping tracking shots, he stages riots, drunken cops pouring into a race riot, chasing black guys down the street, knocking windows out of the hospital. It is so epic. And yet you look at it and you go, I bet he really pulled this out of his ass in a few days. And it's like, that is a pro, man. Like, that is somebody who really knows how to get the value out of something and really make it pop. And it's just, it's a dazzling episode.
Frank,
dialogue.
Yeah, Frank knows I could spend the entire night just, you know, just going on and on about my love for Steven Soderbergh, and I won't bore either one of you, but I completely agree. It's, you know, he's such a unique filmmaker in the sense that he's always constantly trying to put a new spin on material that maybe you've seen before in some way. And I know that he said that he's not going to make any more movies for the big screen. I hope that that's not the case. I hope that at some point we do get a chance to see more movies, because that late run of movies that he did before he, you know, quote unquote retired, I thought was just like electric. And then moving into The Nick, you know, it's just like, it's awesome. And it's like the other thing too, about, I love about the guy. It's like, I love how like he like shoots and edits his own stuff, and like, will shoot and edit the Magic Mike sequel, and like do the second unit on something like The Hunger Games. Like, I've always just been so intrigued by his unending desire to create, it seems like, no matter what he's doing.
Totally. You know, I was just talking to somebody, there was a TV producer here, and we were talking about how, you know, people make their lists. So like in television, for every series, the top of the, you know, if you're picking a director, the top of the list is Steven Soderbergh. And I was talking to someone, and I said, you know, why, this is really interesting to me as someone who's a fan. How is it that Soderbergh's managed to stay on that A list, on the A plus list, basically, even though, you know, he doesn't have that many huge hit movies. He has Magic Mike and I guess like the Oceans movies. But
yeah,
he also has a lot of
Aaron Brockovich. Yeah, Aaron Brockovich and Traffic made money, but outside of those and what you said, he's been a guy who's found a way to make a lot of movies for himself.
Yeah, I mean, what this woman said to me was, she goes, you know, when you see Soderbergh alternating between huge movies and a film as tiny as Bubble or Girlfriend Experience or something like that, there's an awareness of the people who write checks that this guy's always leaning in and he's always on his game in whatever he does. He's not sitting in the back of the limo hitting, you know, the remote. He's in it. As you say, he's shooting it, he cuts it. I've heard that he cuts huge movies on a MacBook in his room, which is awesome, I think.
Yeah, and in his spare time, he decides to do versions of 2001,
yeah.
Which I just think like it's so immensely bold, like of him to do that. But whatever,
it's awesome. But I mean, the point that this woman was making was she was just like, everyone knows you're gonna get this guy's A game every time, whether the thing is a huge hit or it's a disaster or whatever. You know you're gonna get a brilliant person burning the candle at both ends every time. And there's not very many people that you could say that about. There's a lot of coasters in this world, and he's definitely not one.
Yeah, and if I'm not mistaken, didn't he do every episode of season 2?
I believe so, yeah.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
God, I'm so jacked to watch this weekend now.
Hey, oh, you're going to love it.
You'll watch it like in a day. It'll just blow your mind.
So, Matthew, we should probably talk about some of your projects, too. Tell us about what you've got cooking right now.
You know, a bunch of different things. One thing is a script that I wrote a few years ago called Dog Eat Dog. It's based on a novel by Eddie Bunker. Do you guys know Eddie Bunker at all?
Yep. Runaway Train, Mr. Blue.
Runaway Train. He played Mr. Blue in Reservoir Dogs. He's a guy who did 25 years in San Quentin for armed robbery. And he got sprung out of prison. William Styron read his writing, and he's a brilliant writer. And he got out, and, you know, unlike Norman Mailer's guy that he got out, Eddie Bunker didn't kill anybody. He just went on and wrote a lot of books. This is a crime novel about three guys who know each other from juvenile hall, and they all have two felony strikes against them. And, you know, in the time-honored tradition, they go to do one last score. We're going to make one last score, and we're going to get the money and move out of town. Now, everybody who sees this, including the characters, they go, this never works. You know, in every movie, it never works. The one last score, it's always a disaster. But they feel like it's kind of like the Wild Bunch. They sort of feel like, you know, we're going to at least go, we'll go down in a hail of bullets, or, you know, we'll make it out, or we'll die trying. So they enter into it, and Eddie Bunker finds a way. You know, you expect, oh, this is going to be like Fargo, you know, the best laid plans, they turn against each other, you know, and it's totally not that. What happens to them, they get T-boned by fate in the most bizarre way that's almost surreal, but it's perfect. And I won't give it away, but it's really surprising, but totally inevitable, and it's just, it's beautiful. Nicolas Cage plays the main guy of the three friends. We're in the middle of casting the other two friends now. Schrader's directing it in Ohio in October, and he's great. He has some really daring visual ideas. I think this is a movie of his that you're going to see that's going to really surprise you in terms of style. I think people think of Schrader as, you know, Scorsese's like the hot-headed one, and he's the cool, cerebral one. And I think in this one, you're going to see a really different kind of visual style from him. That's a lot more aggressive and kind of crazy. So that's one thing. I have another movie that we're casting right now that's called Old Money. That's about a guy. It's about a rich guy, sort of a Mitt Romney type guy who owns a business. He sells the business to an Amazon-like giant, and he goes from rich to really rich. So he throws a party for his wife. It's her birthday, but he's basically celebrating the fact that he got really rich. So he has this party, and a guy comes who's sort of not very well dressed, comes with his girlfriend and his kind of thug looking friend, and they start whispering in the ears of all these rich people at the party, and they disappear. They pick up their purse and leave, and then they whisper in another guy, and then they leave. People are disappearing. So the family, the rich guy and his family, go into the house, and this sort of mullet-headed guy comes into the house and locks the door and punches the button on the alarm. And the family says, what's the deal? What are you going to rob us? Are you going to murder us? What are you going to do?" And the guy says, "You probably don't remember me, but I'm one of your employees, and you downsized me, and I lost my job, and I lost my wife, and lost my house." You know, it's the country western song. He lost his stuff. And he says, "I'm not going to hurt you guys. I'm not going to steal your stuff. I'm not going to do anything to you, just so long as everybody in this house, by the end of this night, tells the truth to each other." So he sort of forces a lot of secrets out of this family to be told to each other. So it's sort of like a kind of weird combination of like Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf with ultra violence. There's a lot of mayhem and you know, a lot of people who don't make it to the last scene. But it's
that sounds awesome.
Like an emotional horror movie in a way.
Yeah, it's like a little bit of you know, Jason Blum meets, you know, Edward Albee. So, you know, like that. So we're just beginning to cast that now to shoot right after the new year. And it's like a smallish movie, you know, it's all mostly set in this house, but it's kind of a cool ensemble movie. And then we're doing an adaptation with Constantine. If you know those guys, the German producers, Constantine, we're adapting into a mini series, Norman Mailer's Harlot's Ghost, which is a huge novel about the birth of the CIA, and obviously very appropriate to now, and the NSA and Snowden and Assange and so forth. It's the origin story of where all that stuff came from.
Wow.
It's great. It's all the stuff that we're talking about that we like, this kind of television. It's like Mailer wrote a book that just fits that to a T. Speaks to the moment. It's very intimate, great character stuff, big history, big action, but really good intimate character stuff as well. So, look,
oh man,
for that
sounds
soon.
Yeah, all that sounds great. I mean, I loved. I'm really excited for Dog Eat Dog. I mean, I just recently watched Autofocus the other night. Oh. I love that movie to pieces.
Great.
It's so good. I really like Schrader's The Canyons, even though that movie just got obliterated. I thought that was a odd and very, I don't know. I don't even know how I felt, actually, now that I think about it, but I loved it. I haven't seen his last film with Nicolas Cage.
I've not seen that one either. But
I know that one got butchered.
I thought he did a great job of making that movie. That movie, I am told by the producer, they said in the press it cost $250,000, and I was like, yeah, whatever. That's what you say in the press release. And he said, no, it really, really was $250,000. And I thought he really made that movie look good. Really look good. Because it's all canyons. It's like it's all Dallas. Everything he writes is like some posh room. So to like pull that off on $250,000 is like incredible. And I thought he did a great job with that.
Yeah, I enjoyed. I kind of want to watch that again now. I only saw that once, and that was like a couple years ago. But I do want to watch that again. I like that. And Old Money sounds fantastic.
Thank you very much. Appreciate that.
God, it's like The Clearing meets Funny Games. I hope you don't take offense to that.
Oh,
I always hate throwing out references to people who, you know, talking about what they're coming up. But no, man, that sounds like a movie that's like right up my fucking alley.
Right on.
So.
And just because,
yeah.
and because there's, you know, when I ask Matthew real quick too, because there's so much out there right now on, movies and TV, but especially with TV and just the explosion of content, what are some of the other stuff that you've watched of late that maybe we haven't discussed that you would recommend to people to check out?
Let me think about that for a moment. I'm trying to think of what I have seen recently that I thought was really good. What we went through, True Detective. We got Leftovers, Dahl and M. I like Veep. I really do. I think Veep is great. I watch that a lot. I thought
which show?
Veep.
Oh, Veep. Yep. Yeah. Me too. Yep.
Veep. And I have to say, you know what? Like, this chick, you know, she annoys me, but I have to say, I thought season 3 and 4 of Girls is really good. Really good.
Yeah. I gave up after 2. I couldn't do it anymore.
3 and 4 is really, really solid.
I've watched every episode. I've enjoyed the whole thing. I've found it to be quite funny and entertaining, and oftentimes, unfortunately, too truthful, probably. And yeah, I've found the show to actually get better as it's gone on.
You know, what I think is absolutely brilliant, and it's funny. People haven't really gotten into this show that much yet, or like critically, you don't hear great praise of it. But I think it will come in the next few seasons. Silicon Valley. I think that show is like
yes.
Perfect.
It's like there's not a bad episode. It's like it's just spot on.
Yeah, Martin Starr kills it on that show. Very, very, very funny show. Absolutely.
Dan Cryer as the CEO or whatever, the CFO, the like weird Asperger's chick. Fantastic.
There's so much good stuff out. I mean, like, I want to just throw a quick shout out. It's very much outside of sort of the more narratively thoughtful stuff that we've discussed. But are you guys familiar with Banshee?
Yeah, my friend. Do you know Ivana Milosevic? She's the lead woman on the show.
Oh, she's amazing. Running Scared. Oh God, she's been in so many great movies. She fucking is unreal. On Banshee.
Awesome. That's
so
great.
You're friends with her?
Yeah, she was in my first movie. She played – there's a great – if you like her in this, there's a great moment where it's very surreal. It's a movie about Philip K. Dick and Emmett Walsh, who's in all the Conan.
Oh, yeah.
Hell yeah.
Emmett Walsh turns into Ivana Milosevic. You'll never see that in another movie.
What?
How can we see this film?
Wait, yeah, it's your movie?
Yeah.
How do we see this?
I'll get it to you.
Seriously.
Please do. Next time you see her, if you ever talk to her, you tell her she podcasts them softly, huge fan. She's ridiculous on Banshee. That whole show is fucking insane. And it's one of those shows that just gets have you seen much of it or any of it, Matthew?
I've seen just a little bit of it. But you know what? If you want to if you're like a big fan of that, I'll give you her info. I'm sure she would do this in a hot second.
Yes.
Yeah, we would.
Absolutely.
She's been one of those great actresses that has shown up in the background of like all this great genre stuff for like nearly 20 years. I mean, like, just one of those great careers where and now I was like so excited when I started to watch Banshee, and I said to myself, oh wow, she's gonna like get a chance to like have a real role and a real, it's kind of the way I feel about, you know, different show, but Judy Greer. I love Judy Greer and I love the show.
You're obsessed with Judy Greer. I love it.
I think she's wonderful. And it's like everything she's ever been in, she's been great. And now she gets to kill it every week on Married, and she gets a spotlight for her talents. And that's the way I kind of felt about Milosevic on Banshee, is that like she's just ripped into this crazy role. It's like fierce with the sexuality and the violence. I mean, honestly, that show is so packed with head crushing violence, just nudity filled sex. Like it's just such a great base element program. Like I love it. Like I found it to be so massively entertaining. And it was done by Alan Ball, I believe he's responsible for it, and I didn't get into
– Is this the Cinemax show?
Yeah, this is the Cinemax show. It's like – and it's going into its fourth season. They've had some epic fights. I mean, honestly, there was a fight in the last season of Banshee that rivaled some of the shit in the Raid 2. And
I know, but everyone's telling me. It's the best hand-to-hand fight stuff in all of cinema is in Banshee, which blows my mind.
The stuff in Banshee is on the level of, and I don't know, Matthew, if you're big on like extreme action films, the Raid and the Raid 2 for me are like mind-bogglingly amazing films, and on every level. And the stuff in Banshee gets close to the intensity of the shattering of the R rating in the Raid films for me has been like just – it's been amazing to watch, and Hollywood has been so slow on the uptick with, you know, pumping out some really kick-ass action films in the last few years. I hope that it they come around. This has been a great chat, Matthew. I mean, as you can tell, we would talk with you all night. And I mean,
thank you.
You know,
I really appreciate it. I just want to, I got to split in 1 second, but I just want to say one last thing. My brain just turned on. You're saying, what are some other things? I have a really dear friend who I want to just like give a little shout out to. Her name's Melissa Bernstein. When people are talking about like brilliant showrunners and auteur showrunners or whatever, Melissa is somebody that people are going to be saying that about if they're not already. She has two shows on right now that I think are absolute genius, Better Call Saul and Rectify. I don't know if you guys have ever seen that on Sundance.
I have not, but Better Call Saul is fucking genius.
Better Call Saul is a masterpiece. Rectify is great. It's another little, it's a small show. It's about a guy who gets out of prison on a technicality for a murder. He, you know, claims to be innocent. And it's about how his family and his community deal with this guy who he didn't get, he wasn't like, what's the word I'm looking for? Justified. You know, he wasn't proven to be innocent. He just was able to get out. So it's about the sort of the ambiguity of this guy and how people deal with him and the wariness of his girlfriend around him and his mother. And it's small and delicate and really just brilliant writing, great acting, small moments, powerful moments. It's just
– this sounds great.
It's
definitely on my list as well. Better Call Saul, I know Frank and I are big fans.
Oh, dude, that show's so fucking good.
I mean, that's like
a
great American TV show to me. That's it. Like,
All That Jazz reference, I can't remember if that was in the pilot, but the All That Jazz reference, I just like literally jumped out off my couch. It was so great.
Ever.
I know.
It's just there's too much stuff out there. There's too many good shows, and I mean the stuff on Amazon we didn't get a chance to touch. I mean, you got The Affair and Masters of Sex on Showtime, you know, doing different things. I love the format of The Affair, and it truly does feel, and it's like it's cliche to say, but like it truly does feel like a new golden age of television with the emergence of all these people that are really, you know, pushing out this creative stuff.
I couldn't agree more. Thanks for having me, guys. I really appreciate it.
Of course.
Thank you so much for coming on.
Have a beautiful night.
You too, man.
Right, bye-bye.
Be in touch. Bye.